To catch us up to where we are in Zechariah. We began chapter 9 last week, and by the way, I did get this chart finished up last night, so I didn't have time to run it off for you. You'll get the finished time frame chart next week. Anyway, we started off in chapter 9, verses 1 through 8. It was a prediction in the near future where Zechariah predicted the coming of Alexander the Great. We learned in chapter 9, verses 1 through 8, that God was going to bring a judgment upon certain areas of the land. He would bring judgment upon Syria with its capital at Damascus, Hamat, which is to the north and west of Syria, then on Tyre and Sidon, and we looked at the fulfillment of this prophecy when Tyre was finally taken by Alexander the Great. Alexander then would move south, and Philistia would feel the judgment of God. Then with his back secure to the Mediterranean and his supply lines secure, it would be logical for Alexander to move inland and take Jerusalem, which he started to do. But you remember when he came to Jerusalem, what happened? He saw his vision again. He had seen a vision in Macedonia of the man dressed in unique robes coming out toward him. And Jewish legend says that the high priest, dressed in his high priestly golden garments, came out to greet Alexander the Great. Alexander, in his vision, saw the plate on the head of the high priest that said, Kadosh La Adonai, holy to the Lord. He didn't understand what it said, but he knew from the vision that this man, this individual, represented the Most High God, and that he was to bow and submit to the Most High God, which he did. Then he turned around and went south and conquered Egypt instead. Now, the day class, when I did the review, guess what they wanted? They wanted that map there. So whether you guys like it or not, I did make a copy of the map. So I'm going to hand that out to you. And this map covers those areas listed in Zechariah 9, 1 through 8. Okay, how are we doing? Everybody got a copy of the map? Yeah, the day crew doesn't hesitate to ask at all these days, I tell you. Now, when we get to chapter 9, verse 8, the first part of the verse, part A, deals with Alexander and the fact that Jerusalem was protected when Alexander the Great came down and came against her. God protected Jerusalem. That's the point there. In the second half of the verse, we jump into the far future, into the Messianic Kingdom, and God's point in the last part of verse 8 was, I will protect Jerusalem again. Not in exactly the same way, not in exactly the same situation, but I protected Jerusalem from Alexander. I can also protect Jerusalem ultimately from the Antichrist. That's the point of this quick jump into the future. But, question.
So in verse 8 where it says, because the hand who passes by and returns, is that a reference to Alexander?
Yes, because Alexander passed by and returned, passed by Jerusalem and returned a number of times. He never bothered Jerusalem. And he also took Tyre, so we can pretty much pinpoint that to Alexander. Then in verse 9, Israel is told to rejoice. Chapter 9, verse 9, rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout in triumph, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. He is just and endowed with salvation, humble and mounted on a donkey, even a colt, the foal of a donkey. And here we come to we jump back from the Messianic Kingdom to the first coming of the Messiah himself. And in 9, verse 9, we take a look at Yeshua's first coming. A king is coming to you, Israel, and so you are to rejoice. It's not a Greek king who brings war and bloodshed. It's your king. It's the Jewish king. He comes holy. He comes, what's the word I'm looking for? He comes riding on a donkey. He isn't coming in the pomp and power of war. He's coming as the suffering Messiah. So in chapter 9, we looked at the characteristics of the Messiah. And then now we pick it up in verse 10. And in verse 10, we're going to jump 2,000 years over to the Yeshua's second coming. So this the gap between verse 9 and verse 10 is a 2,000-year gap in time. This is a blend prophecy. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, there are four types of messianic prophecies. And I'll just put up those four types on the overhead. Four types of messianic prophecies that you'll find. Some messianic prophecies deal only with Yeshua's first coming. First coming only, that's all they talk about. The second type deals with second coming events only, and that's all they talk about. First coming is not in view. The messianic kingdom is not in view, just the judgment usually at the second coming. So we have first coming prophecies and second coming prophecies. But we also have a section of prophecies, or a number of prophecies, that we call blend prophecies, in which the first coming and the second coming are blended together into one picture. And there's no hint of the time gap between the first and second coming. And this is a good example. Here, the traditional verse break the first coming up into verse 9 and the second coming up into verse 10. Sometimes this happens right in the middle of a verse. But again, this is a blend prophecy because the first and second comings are blended together into one picture. We only know of the time gap because of where we sit and because of the in time and because of the New Testament. Then there's a final type of messianic prophecy that we call entire redemptive career, because this covers the first coming, the interval, the second coming, and the kingdom. All of them are seen in that particular type of prophecy. For example, Psalm 110 is an entire redemptive career prophecy. Okay? So those are the four types. First coming only, second coming only, the first and second blended together, and then the final type bringing all the facets of the Messiah's appearances together in one place. Okay? So right now, we're going to jump 2,000 years into the future, or 2,000 years beyond the first coming, and take a look at the second coming in verse 10. I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem, and the bow of war will be cut off, and he, referring back to the Messiah, Israel's king, and he will speak peace to the nations, and his dominion will be from sea to sea, from the river to the ends of the earth. So what's going to happen during the second coming? A number of things. A, point A on page 330. The instruments of war are removed from Israel. The chariot, the horse, the battle bow, all disappear from Israel. And of course, God is speaking to Zechariah in terms that Zechariah can understand. So these may be, very well could be, modern instruments of war, but Zechariah wouldn't understand what those things would be. So he speaks of the chariot, the horse, and the battle bow. And then point B, the Messiah will speak peace to the nations. He's going to cause peace to come. He's going to end warfare. There's not going to be any need for these instruments of war anymore. So the IDF is out of a job. I won't be able to go over and volunteer anymore, will I? IDF will be out of a job. There'll be no need for the medical corps. You know, those are the guys I volunteered for. So I won't be needed over there. I'll be living there, so I guess I won't have a problem getting over there. So the IDF is out of a job, and so is the U.S. Army and every other army. There's going to be an end to warfare. And this happens to be the primary objection that you'll run into when you start witnessing to a Jewish person about the Messiah, about Yeshua. The number one spoken objection usually goes like this. Well, the Messiah is supposed to bring peace. Jesus didn't bring peace. Jesus can't be the Messiah. And they get that idea right here out of chapter 9, verse 10. Because, yes, indeed, the Messiah is supposed to bring peace. The point is, when they make that objection, the person is ignoring half of the messianic picture. The other half of the messianic picture is verse 9. Okay, so if your Jewish friend brings that objection before you, refer them to verse 9 and say, you've got to look at the humble, suffering Messiah as well as the conquering, reigning Messiah. Both pieces of the puzzle have to be there to get a complete picture of the Messiah. And so don't let them get away with a half the picture and claim that Jesus didn't fulfill that half. Of course he hasn't fulfilled it, but he did fulfill the first half. Ask them who fulfilled that. Okay, so the instruments of war removed, peace will come. And then in the third section of verse 10, the messianic reign is described. His dominion is explained. And this is a quote of Psalm 72, verse 8. And by the way, I did the day class did implore me to make this chart. So let me hand this chart out before I say anything, so you'll get a chance to write any notes on it that you'd like to write on it. Basically, what the psalmist, what was revealed to the psalmist in Psalm 72, verse 8, is picked up by Zechariah a number of years later and repeated. I think I've said this before, that many of the teachings in Scripture do not float out there all on their own, isolated. Many of the teachings of Scripture are repeated a number of places, and you just have to learn to recognize them. When you recognize them, you say, oh yeah, I've run across that before. Here it is again. Okay, Psalm 72, verse 8. May he also rule from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. And then Zechariah picks that up. I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem, and the bow of war will be cut off, so no more instruments of war. And he will speak peace to the nations. There's the Messiah bringing peace. And his dominion, here's his messianic rule, will be from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. And now you'll notice on your notes that Dr. Fruchtenbaum has put down there, from sea to sea, from the Dead Sea to the Mediterranean Sea. And that is a good possibility here. From the Dead Sea right here to the Mediterranean Sea, the Sea of the Philistines, the Western Sea, the Great Sea being the western border of Israel and the kingdom, and the southeastern border running down here. So that's a good possibility. But, you know, as I got thinking about it, I thought there was another option as well, from sea to sea. It might be a better option. And God might be talking about this area right here. This might be just as good an option, from the what we call the Gulf of Aqaba to the Mediterranean Sea. And the reason I like that option is because that more closely parallels Israel's southern border. So from the Dead Sea to the Mediterranean Sea, or perhaps from the Gulf of Aqaba to the Mediterranean Sea, and then he says from the river to the ends of the earth. Well, the river is always a reference to the Euphrates. So if he may be just talking about the northern and southern boundaries of the land in the kingdom. I kind of think that's the best option. From the southern end of Israel to the northern end of Israel to all of the earth will be the dominion of the Messiah. And as we've gone through the minor prophets, I've shown you I have given you this chart here, haven't I? Did I give that to you? We've seen that this will probably be the borders of Israel in the Messianic Kingdom. So here, that's why I drew that line down here. From sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. So that basically just outlines in a general fashion the land of Israel. So that's the dominion of the Messiah. Not only will he rule in Israel, not only will he establish a kingdom that will be centered in Jerusalem as the capital city and Israel as the capital country, but it's going to go out and cover the entire world as well. Okay, that takes care of page 330. Let's move over to page 331. And at the top of page 331, you see point number 3, rabbinical explanations. And what is Dr. F. getting at there? Well, basically, he put that section in because the rabbis were perplexed by the two apparently contradictory pictures of the Messiah that we've just seen in verse 9 and 10. How can we have a humble Messiah and a reigning Messiah, a suffering Messiah and a ruling Messiah, a conquering Messiah? How can that possibly be? And so you see point A there. They came up with a solution to this dilemma, and the rabbinic solution is called the two Messiah view. Basically, the rabbis postulate that two Messiahs will come, each one coming once. Now, of course, we feel that it's one Messiah coming twice. The rabbis say two Messiahs coming once. Okay, do you see that fancy finger work there? One Messiah coming twice, two Messiahs coming once. That's the two Messiah theory. Basically, the rabbis say that the first Messiah will be Mashiach ben Yosef, Messiah ben Joseph. He's the Messiah spoken of in verse 9. He's the suffering, humble Messiah. He will come first. He will be killed in the wars of Gog and Magog. And then, shortly after he is killed, Mashiach ben David will come. The second Messiah will come, Messiah son of David. He's the reigning Messiah of verse 10. So we have two Messiahs, Messiah ben Yosef, the son of Joseph, and Messiah son of David. Okay, is that clear? That's how the rabbis reconcile this apparent contradiction. By the way, isn't it ironic that that the suffering Messiah is called Ben Yosef? And who was the stepfather of Yeshua? Well, who is his guardian? Yeshua's guardian was a man known as Yosef, isn't it?
Where did they get that name?
They get it from Joseph of Genesis, how he was persecuted by his brothers and thrown into the cistern, and then rescued and taken down to Egypt, and then he suffered. That was the point, that Joseph suffered, and so they call him Messiah, son of Joseph. Now, point B is a nice little rabbinic quote that relates to verse 10 here. Rabbi Joseph, the son of Levi, objects. That is written in one place. In other words, he's confused here. It's written in one place, "Behold, one like a son of man comes with the clouds of heaven." See, there's your reigning Messiah. But in another place, it is written, "Lowly and riding on an ass." How can we reconcile these two? And here's how he reconciled it. Verse 9 there is actually what it is. The solution is, if they be righteous, if Israel be righteous, he, the Messiah, will come with the clouds of heaven. If they be not righteous, he shall come lowly and riding on an ass. Now, what happened? What happened when the Messiah first came? He came lowly and riding on an ass. And what was Israel's condition? Unrighteous. And what is our condition today? Unrighteous. Same. But when Yeshua comes the second time and he's going to come riding on the clouds of heaven, what will Israel's condition be then? Righteous. Because there will be a national regeneration of Israel preceding the second coming. We all place our faith in him, call on him to, and are born again, regenerated, call on him to return, and he returns with the clouds of heaven. So the rabbi has it right here. He doesn't realize that it applies to Yeshua, but he's got the basic idea right. This is what tears me up in the Jewish community. These are some of the gems you run across when you study rabbinic writings. So we got to get the word out who the right guy is. It isn't Rabbi Schneerson. It's Yeshua, the rejected one. Okay? Now, in order to give you a little bit more information on all this, I ran off an article from Encyclopedia Judaica on Messiah in rabbinic thought. I edited it down a little bit so it would fit on two sides of a sheet of paper. I also put in this, on the back, some recommended reading, the Messiah text by Dr. Raphael Patai. He's an Israeli scholar, and he's taken all the biblical texts and the vast majority, if not all, of the rabbinic texts on the Messiah and put them in one book. And all the major doctrines that we read about and look at are there in the table of contents. He has a whole section on the suffering Messiah. He has a whole section on the conquering Messiah. He's got a section on the mother of the Messiah, because the Messiah's father is never stated. Yeah, so it's got a, he's got a section on the birth pangs of the Messiah, the tribulation period. So it's great reading. If you're interested in picking it up, I would recommend it highly. The Messiah Text by Raphael Patai, and I've given you some purchasing information there if you're interested. So fascinating reading on the Messiah in rabbinic thought. Okay, let's continue on with on page 331. Now we're going to jump back to our time frames chart again. We've just looked at the coming of the Messiah, who's going to protect Israel, just as Israel was protected from Alexander the Great. Jerusalem will be protected again. He'll be protected by the Messiah, who will come lowly and also come as a king. But now Zechariah, or God, jumps back to the near future again in verses 11 through 13. And in verses 11 through 13, Zechariah deals with another near prediction. He deals with another deliverance that Israel experiences. In this section, verses 11 through 13, he's going to be dealing with the deliverance that came from the Maccabean revolt. See, the Greeks did... They didn't destroy Jerusalem or attack Jerusalem, but they did dominate the area. They were the third kingdom of the Daniel's four kingdoms that are going to be biblically important. And so Israel did come under the thumb of the Greeks, and it was during the time of Antiochus Epiphanes that tremendous persecution came against the Jewish people. That persecution was thrown off by the Maccabees. And that successful and miraculous revolt is remembered during the festival of Hanukkah. Festival of Hanukkah. So we're going to look at the Maccabean revolt. And then in verse 14, he's going to jump forward to the tribulation period and the second coming. And what's the relationship? Just as you were delivered from Antiochus Epiphanes, you will be delivered during the tribulation period. By the way, Antiochus Epiphanes prefigures the Antichrist, because he sets up an abomination of desolation, so will the Antichrist. So what I did for you here, I will do in greater scale here. What I did for you here, I will do in greater scale for you here. You see the relationship there? That's why he jumps back and then comes forward. Okay, so let's take a look at the deliverance during the time of the Maccabees, from the Greeks, especially Antiochus Epiphanes. So we start in verse 11. Verse 11 gives us the basis for God's deliverance of Israel. Chapter 9, verse 11. As for you also, because of the blood of my covenant with you, I have set your prisoners free from the waterless pit. As for you also, point A, he's referring to Israel. I am going to deliver you, he says, basically by the blood of the covenant. And this is a reference to the Abrahamic covenant. And the Abrahamic covenant is an unconditional, eternal covenant that God made with the Jewish people, starting with our patriarch Abraham. And way back in Genesis chapter 15, in the early sections of Genesis 15, Abraham was told to take some animals and to sacrifice them and to cut them in half and line them up in two rows. And the way covenants were signed and sealed in those days, the people who were making the covenant would then walk between the rows. And they were saying, basically, what happened to these animals, may it happen to me if I break my part of the covenant. Now, in Genesis 15, Avram never walked through the pieces. God alone went through the pieces in the form of this smoking pot and fiery torch, two expressions of the Shekhinah, God's promise. And so this covenant that God formalizes with Abraham in Genesis 15 is binding upon God only. So it's an unconditional, eternal covenant. God will see that it gets fulfilled. Here's what we read in Genesis 15. And it came about when the sun had set that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven right there, and a flaming torch which passed between the pieces. Avram is off on the side in a deep sleep. On that day the Lord made a covenant with Avram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land from the river of Egypt. There's that southern boundary of the land again, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. There's the northern boundary of the land, exactly as we saw on that chart I handed out to you. And then the people inhabiting that territory are named. These are the Canaanite tribes that live there. And not one of them are Palestinians, not one of them are Arabs. Kenite, Kezanite, Kadmonite, Hittite, Perizzite, Rephaim, Amorite, Canaanite, Girgashite, and Jebusite. Those are the tribes that were kicked out of that territory that God wanted gone. They are gone. They don't exist anymore. The Palestinians are not the descendants of the Canaanites. So that's the covenant that God is operating upon, the unconditional, eternal Abrahamic covenant. And he says, point C there, I have set your prisoners free from the pit and wherein there is no water. This is a reference to cisterns being used as prisons. And remember when Joseph was tossed into that cistern? There's no way he can get out of that. The cisterns in Israel, many of them are dug into the ground. They're very deep. And it's as though Israel will be in an inescapable situation. Okay, when the Maccabeans have to fight their way out, it's as though they're going to be imprisoned in a cistern. Okay, let's move on to page 332. So God has said, I will deliver you on the basis of the Abrahamic covenant. Another principle that he brings out in regard to Israel is the principle of rendering double to Israel. Verse 12. Here's the second principle of deliverance. Return to the stronghold, O prisoners who have the hope. This day I am declaring that I will restore double to you. So not only will I save you on basis of the covenant from a very hopeless situation, but I'm going to restore double to you. What's that all about? Well, let's start with point A there. The Jewish people are described as prisoners of the hope. The word there is Hatikva. That's the name of Israel's national anthem, Hatikva. So it's basically the messianic hope that we're talking about there. But then he moves in point B, he moves into the principle of rendering double. And you see point one there, the firstborn principle. Basically, Israel is considered God's firstborn, Exodus 4, 22 and 23. Exodus is considered to be, or pictured as, God's firstborn son. And in ancient Near Eastern inheritance rules, the firstborn receives a double inheritance. He's the first fruits of the family. He's the one whom the family line, the family name, will continue through. So the firstborn was very important, the first offspring of the husband's strength and vigor and youth. So the firstborn received a double inheritance. If you had three kids, you would divide the inheritance into four pieces. You'd give two to the firstborn and then the remaining two to the last two. So that's how the double inheritance worked. So the firstborn gets double inheritance. Now, in Israel's case, it's double punishment for iniquity and double blessing for obedience. So it's not always fun to be Jewish, you guys. You know, there's a lot of people that want to be Jewish out there. It's not always fun. So we will receive double punishment for our iniquity, and that's basically one of the purposes of the tribulation period. And that's brought out in Isaiah 40 and Jeremiah 16, the cross-references on your notes there. In regard to that tribulation period, God says, speak kindly to Jerusalem and call out to her that her warfare is ended, that her iniquity has been removed, that she has received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins. That's the reference to the tribulation. It's going to be a tough time on us. Jeremiah 16:18, similar reference. I will first doubly repay their iniquity and their sin, because they have polluted my land, they have filled my inheritance with carcasses of their detestable idols and their abominations. So Israel, we Jewish people are doubly responsible to live obedient and righteous lives before God. And so with double privilege comes double responsibility and double punishment. But also comes double blessing. And that's what Isaiah brings out in Isaiah 61:7, again in your notes, speaking of the Messianic kingdom. Instead of your shame, you will have a double portion. Instead of humiliation, they will shout for joy over their portion. Therefore, they will possess a double portion in their land. Everlasting joy will be theirs. So sometimes it will be fun to be Jewish. But the responsibility is there. It's a very heavy and serious responsibility. And so that's the principle that's brought out in verse 12. I will redeem you on the basis of the Abrahamic covenant. I will redeem you on the basis of this principle of rendering double unto you. Now, how is this going to happen? How is this going to come about? That's in verse 13. Israel will be empowered to withstand the Gentiles. Now, again, we're talking here about the Maccabean revolt. For I will bend Judah as my bow, and I will fill the bow with Ephraim. And I will stir up your sons, O Zion, against your sons, O Greece, and I will make you like a warrior's sword. So points 1 and 2, Judah is pictured as the bow, a warrior's bow. Ephraim is pictured as arrows in the bow. See, the bow filled with Ephraim. And so Israel will be God's warriors, and it will be the entire nation, not only Judah, but the northern kingdom of Ephraim, the entire nation will become God's warriors. Who will they come against? I will stir up thy sons, O Zion, against Greece. Now here's your reference to the Maccabean Wars. The Maccabees will come against the Greeks of Antiochus Epiphany and will win miraculous victories. A small ragtag guerrilla army against the largest, most equipped, best disciplined army in the world at the time, and we will win. I will make thee as the sword of a mighty man. Indeed, that's what the Maccabees were. So at this point, God's description of the Maccabean Wars ends, and we now jump forward. We're in verse 13. We're now going to jump forward into the greater deliverance that will come from the Antichrist during the time of Jacob's trouble. So we move into the tribulation and Yeshua's second coming in 9:14 through 10. There'll be a little difference, though. Again, Israel will defeat her enemies and be faced with enemies intent on her total destruction. But in the kingdom, it's God himself who's going to be doing the fighting. It's God himself who's going to be doing the fighting. Not simply empowering the Jewish armies, but he himself will intervene personally. So now we move into a quick glance at the campaign of Armageddon. And the day class wanted me to emphasize that word campaign. It's usually called the Battle of Armageddon, and it's usually viewed as one big battle. Boom, that's it. Actually, it's not. The campaign of Armageddon is a 3.5-year campaign that starts up in the Jezreel Valley there, near Megiddo, moves down to Jerusalem, down to Petra Basra, and back to Jerusalem over a 3.5-year period. It is a campaign with many things happening, not just one battle. Okay, so now let's turn to verse 14. And we see that when God intervenes on the basis of the Abrahamic covenant, on the basis of double blessing, on the basis of empowering the Jewish people, now we move into the campaign of Armageddon. We see that God, when he delivers Israel during that time period, he is going to intervene personally. Verse 14. Then the Lord will appear over them, and his arrow will go forth like lightning. And the Lord God will blow the trumpet and will march in the storm winds of the south. So there's a lot of amazing pictures here that God draws for us. Jehovah will be seen over them. He will be seen hovering over the Jewish people like the cloud did in the wilderness. And we know that when Yeshua returns, I believe his initial spot will be Bozrah Petra, and he'll return with the clouds of heaven, with the Shekinah glory. So I think that's a reference to the Shekinah glory and God's presence over the Jewish people when Yeshua returns. Jehovah is the bowman, and so God is doing battle with the enemy. Jehovah will blow the trumpet. That's a shofar, by the way, and this is a battle cry. And he will advance in the whirlwinds of the south. The picture there is of the hot Arabic Khamsin winds blowing across the land, bringing their dry heat and the devastating sandstorms. And we know how devastating those sandstorms can be when we invaded Iraq, didn't we? Our soldiers even had their teeth coated with sand. It brought everything to a standstill. And that's, say again? Yeah, right, Persian Gulf, right. And so it's quite an apt picture of God coming in and bringing everything to a standstill as he intervenes. Then in verse 15 on page 333, we get a little more detailed look at the defense that God puts up for Israel. Verse 15, the Lord of hosts will defend them, and they will devour and trample on the slingstones, and they will drink and be boisterous as with wine, and they will be filled like a sacrificial basin, drenched like the corners of the altar. And so the picture we get here of God's defense is massive bloodletting. God defending, God devouring and subduing, Israel drinking their blood. Pretty gory scene here. The defense of Israel is being likened here to a sacrifice. Notice the last few phrases. They will be filled like a sacrificial basin. When the sacrifice was killed, the gold basin caught the blood, and the blood was filled up in the basin. So this defense is the armies of the Antichrist are going to be like this basin filled with blood, and then what happens to the basin? It's dashed against the corners of the altar. And this altar is described as drenched in blood. So it's a very extreme picture. And that's a consistent picture that God draws for us of the Battle of Armageddon. We went up, remember Isaiah 34? We read Isaiah 34 earlier on, so I thought it would be a good time to reread Isaiah 34. Here it is. This is the Battle of Armageddon again. Draw near, O nations, to hear and listen, O peoples. Let the earth and all it contains hear, and the world and all that springs from it. So this is a worldwide event. For the Lord's indignation is against all the nations, and his wrath against all their armies. See, they've all gathered against Israel. He has utterly destroyed them. He has given them over to slaughter. And so their slain will be thrown out, and their corpses will give off their stench, and the mountains will be drenched with their blood. You don't often see this in devotionals, do you? I don't think anyone would put this in a devotional book. And the host of heaven will wear away, and the sky will be rolled up like a scroll. All their hosts will also wither away as a leaf withers from the vine, or as one withers from the fig tree. My sword is satiated in heaven. Behold, it shall descend for judgment upon Edom and upon the people whom I have devoted to destruction. That's the armies of the Antichrist. The sword of the Lord is filled with blood. It is sated with fat, with the blood of lambs and goats, with the fat of the kidneys of rams. For the Lord has what? A sacrifice in Bozrah, a great slaughter in the land of Edom. The wild oxen shall also fall with them, the young bulls and the strong ones. Thus their land will be soaked with blood and their dust become greasy with fat. So the Battle of Armageddon is going to be quite an intense battle, quite a gory battle. Do you think the Passion was a gory movie? Well, okay, well, next project for Mel Gibson, huh? The Battle of Armageddon. And notice, though, that those that are destroyed, the armies of the Antichrist, are considered a sacrifice. You know, God does not enjoy destroying all these people that come against Israel. He doesn't look on it as fun and games. He views it, as horrible as it is, as a sacrifice, a necessary sacrifice that is correct and a righteous thing to do, but a sacrifice nonetheless, not a time of fun. Okay, so that's the defense God has for Israel. The deliverance is brought out in verse 16. And the Lord their God will save them in that day as the flock of his people, for they are as the stones of a crown sparkling in his land. And two comments are made there. First of all, it says that God will save Israel as a flock. And here God is picturing himself as the good shepherd. The good shepherd running to the defense of his sheep when he sees the lion, the bear, the wolf about to rip the sheep apart, rip the flock apart. And so God is pictured as the good shepherd. And that's how Yeshua spoke of himself, didn't he? I am the good shepherd. Not only will he come to the flock's defense, but he's also willing to lay his life down for the flock. Second picture, they shall be as stones of a crown. And here Israel is pictured as God's treasured possession. And that's why God is willing to sacrifice the armies of the Antichrist, because his treasured possession is in danger. And a cross-reference for that is Deuteronomy 26:18. So the Jewish people there are pictured as these glittering stones in a crown, sparkling and beautiful, God's treasured possession. And from this incredible deliverance comes praise in verse 17. For what comeliness and beauty will be theirs? Grain will make the young men flourish, and the new wine, the virgins. So instead of being downtrodden and destroyed and wiped out, Israel, God intervenes and Israel is delivered and uplifted, and Israel will prosper. And point three there, grain, and point four, new wine, are both symbols of prosperity and health. So not only will the Jewish people survive this due to God's intervention, but then we slide into the kingdom just a little bit here. They will be transformed, prosperous, healthy, joyful. Well, we'll continue looking at the salvation of Israel as we move into chapter 10, but this is a logical place to break. So why don't we take a 15-minute break, and when you hear the shofar, come on back. We'll resume the battle. And we'll go into chapter 10. righty, we're on the page 333 in your exegetical outline notes. We're ready to start into chapter 10. So as you pass those charts down, when you get yours, just pass it down, and I'll pick up any extras. Okay, Sandy, we need a few up in the second row here, if you could pass them forward. Anyone need the chart of the Abrahamic Covenant? Anybody at all need it? Any extras? We got them here. Pass them back to Sandy. Okay. Everybody got a copy of that chart? Okay, wonderful. Sandy, I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Okay, can I have your attention, please? All right, let's go on to, as we continue looking at this deliverance in the during the campaign of Armageddon, we come in chapter 10 to the salvation of Israel and some of the restored blessings. We saw that when this deliverance occurs from God's intervention, Israel will be uplifted and prosper. Another blessing is promised in verse 1 of chapter 10. Oops, where'd I go here? Chapter 10, verse 1. Ask rain from the Lord at the time of the spring rain. And the Lord who makes the storm clouds, he will give them showers of rain, vegetation in the field to each man. Now in chapter 10, verse 1, there's a number of terms for rain found in this verse. Three of those, there's four terms here in your outline. Three of them are found in the verse. The first term, A there, yoreh, is not found in the verse. It's included because it refers to the former rain. This is the early rain, the autumn rain in October and November. That is not mentioned here. The other three are. So that's the former rain. That's the beginning of the rainy season. Matar, point B there, is just an ordinary reference for rain, ordinary rain. Point C, Geshem, is the heavy rain. This is the winter rain that runs from December through March. And this season of rain has just come to a close in Israel this year. And what we're praying for when I make my announcements is point D, the Malkush, the latter rain, the spring rains that come in March and April. And that's the rains we're looking for right now when I mention the announcements to you. So you have the former rain or the early rain, autumn rain in October, November, then the ordinary rain, then the winter rain in December through March, the Geshem, and then the Malkush, the latter rains, that's the spring rains in March and April. Now if these rains come in the correct season, it is considered a special blessing, because if they fall as expected, Israel will experience bumper crops. So rain is very, very important in Scripture and in the Jewish mind and in the Israeli mind even today. And because of that, what I did is I put together a little article on rain with a map of Israel's rainfall. This map, unfortunately, it's not in color, but it is on your... It's nice, pretty blue, isn't it? But it is on your chart here in black and white. And you can still see, pretty much see the rainfall as it comes down in Israel. See to the north in Upper Galilee, that's the highest and wettest section of Israel up here in Upper Galilee. I like that area. When I went to Israel in 94, I was living in Portland, Oregon, and Upper Galilee was my favorite area. It reminded me the most of Oregon. Very green and very cool, very nice. But then the rain peters out as you move south. And here, of course, in the Arabah and the desert, it's gone. But it peters out as you go down into Judah and into the Arabah. So this article will fill you in on rain. And if you read it, you'll see how important rain is in the Scripture and in the Jewish mind. Okay, let's turn over to page 334. Basically, the point that's made on point 2 and point 3 here is that you ask for rain, you're going to get all the rain you need. In the kingdom, there'll be no lack for rain and the bumper crops and the prosperity that Israel needs. So that's point 3 and 2 and 3. It says, point 3b, enough for every blade of grass. There's not even a single blade of grass is going to go thirsty in the kingdom. That's how prosperous it's going to be. And this promise of rain is a promise found in the Mosaic Law. Obedience, God says in Leviticus and Deuteronomy there, will bring rain in its proper time. And so you'll get those bumper crops. But disobedience will bring drought. It's interesting that Israel is still living under the Mosaic Covenant today, and Israel has experienced 10 years of drought up until this year. 10 years of drought. So, again, we are not living in obedience to the Mosaic Law, and so that's what's happening today. In verse 2, we're going to learn that during the tribulation, Israel is going to be characterized by the rise of false prophets. And basically, God is saying here that my salvation is not going to come through idolatry, and it's not going to come through false prophets. So verse 2. For the teraphim speak iniquity, and the diviners see lying visions and tell false dreams. They comfort in vain. Therefore, the people wander like sheep. They are afflicted because there is no shepherd. And so the idolatry that's going to be prevalent in the tribulation is going to fail. The false prophets that are going to pop up during the tribulation are also going to fail. And the results is point 3 near the bottom of the page. The flock will be scattered because there's no shepherd to guide the flock in the way of truth. This will be developed more in chapter 13. Page 335. Teraphim are household gods. They were little things that were put in niches. It's like making a chapel in your home or something. Rachel stole some household gods. Yeah, and she hid them under the saddle. Well, they weren't very big. They were little tiny things, but they were worshipped. In fact, we have a lady in the morning class who's from India. She's a Christian from India, and she says that's what the Hindus do today, even today. They have these little household gods in niches and stuff in their homes. So it's still prevalent today. Okay, so there'll be a failure of the idols and the false prophets, but on page 335, in the first part of verse 3, there's also a failure of leadership, Israel's shepherds. Verse 3, my anger is kindled against the shepherds. I will punish the male goats. And that reference to shepherds and male goats are parallel references to leaders, the Jewish leaders who lead the flock astray. Again, to be developed in chapter 11 when we get there. So in the tribulation, the leadership of Israel will be poor. But Israel will be empowered to withstand the Gentiles. Second part of verse 3. For the Lord of hosts has visited his flock, the house of Judah, and he will make them like his majestic horse in battle. Now, this reference to a horse, of course, is to a reference to one of the most important symbols of warfare. A horse was a very valuable military resource in those days. And he says the house of Judah will be like God's majestic horse in battle. He's going to empower the IDF in the Battle of Armageddon. We'll see that a little later on. But then in verse 4, we move from God empowering Israel to the one who will come and really be the source of empowering. That's the Messiah himself in verse 4. From them will come the cornerstone, from them the tent peg, from them the bow of battle, from them every ruler, all of them together. And here in verse 4, we come to one of those translation decisions that have come across our path from time to time. Now, in verse 4, we're talking about the source of the Messiah, the source of his origin. And the Hebrew word used there can be translated one of two ways, validly. It can be translated either from them, as the NASB has translated it, or it can be translated, as your notes have it, from him. Now, if the proper translation is the translation from him, as Dr. Fruchtenbaum prefers here, then that points out that the source of the Messiah is divine. It's referring back in verse 3 to the Lord of hosts. So any reference to him, and your Bibles, I don't know how your Bibles translate it. My NASB has from them. I know some of the people in the morning class said, and there's a note that says him. Okay, so they're recognizing that it can go either way. So if it's validly translated from him, that's referring to the divine origin of the Messiah. If it's translated them, and that could be valid, it's referring to the human origin of the Messiah. It's referring back to Judah. And maybe that's why God chose to use this pronoun that can go either way, because it can speak either of the divine or human origin of the Messiah. And he is the God-man. So maybe God deliberately wanted it that way. But we'll go with the translation in the notes here. From him will come forth the cornerstone. From God will come forth the cornerstone, or the foundation stone. And the Messiah here is being pictured as a stone. And the foundation stone, the cornerstone there, is the most important stone in a building. From it, all the other measurements are taken. And so he is going to be the foundation of Israel's salvation and leadership. He's the cornerstone. And that's another picture of Messiah that comes out in other sections of Scripture. Secondly, from him, the nail. From God will come the nail. Or point B1 there. Tent peg would be a better translation. The NASB does it as tent peg. Nail is okay, but I think tent peg gives you a better idea of what's happening here. This is a reference to the center pole in the tent, in the Bedouin-type tent. The center tent pole that was quite thick and held up the tent. And then into that tent pole was inserted the tent peg, a little peg sticking out of the pole. And on that peg, all the valuables of the family were hung. Why were they hung on that tent peg? Because it was on the pole in the middle of the tent, and you slept all around that pole. So if somebody wanted to come into your tent to steal your valuables, they had to walk over you. Okay, so it was pretty secure. They had to walk over you, your kids, your animals, whatever. So that was the safe space, the safe spot. Hang everything from the center pole on the tent peg. And that's a nice picture of the Messiah, because everything is going to hang on him. He is the valuable tent peg that holds everything up. Everything important is going to originate and hang on him. Thirdly, from him, from God, is the battle bow. And this is, as Dr. Fruchtenbaum points out here, the means by which the false shepherds are removed. So Messiah is also going to be a warrior and a defender. The battle bow, of course, being a picture of a very important military weapon in those days. So the Messiah will be a warrior. And then finally, point D, from God, every ruler together. He's going to be the source of authority. He's going to be the King of Kings, the ruler of rulers. Not only the ruler of Israel, but the ruler of the world. Now, that word ruler is another one of those Hebrew words, those soft-edged Hebrew words that can go either way. It could be translated as oppressor, given the context, or it can be translated positively as ruler, given the context. Here, I think it should be a positive translation. Your version might, the translating team might have chosen the negative version, oppressor. Anyone have oppressor out there?
Well, there's no in the NASB for oppressor, but
okay, you're well, yeah, I don't think quite that's the way it's going. But yeah, it's good that the NASB notes that there is, it could be rendered the other way. It depends on the context. It's a translation decision that depends on the context, and you know, translators can look at the context from different ways. That's part of the art of exegesis. The science of exegesis is the word, and what does it mean, and its range of meaning. The art is picking the correct range of meaning, the correct point for the context, because it can only mean one thing given a certain context. So that's why you have some of these problems. Okay, so the Messiah will come out of this deliverance as well. Not only will come punishment for that which is false, and prosperity for the obedient, but the Messiah himself. Page 336. Now, the results of the empowerment of Israel during the campaign of Armageddon is found in verse 5. They will be as mighty men, treading down the enemy in the mire of the streets in battle. And they will fight, for the Lord will be with them, and the riders on horses will be put to shame. So the picture in verse 5 is total victory. Total victory. The enemies are pictured as mud stomped on in the streets. Israel is rescued in verse 6. I shall strengthen the house of Judah. I shall save the house of Joseph. I shall bring them back because I have had compassion on them. And they will be as though I had not rejected them. For I am the Lord their God, and I will answer them. So points A and B, he's going to strengthen and save Judah and Joseph. Judah would be a reference to the southern kingdom. Joseph would be a reference to the northern kingdom. In other words, all Israel is going to be strengthened and saved. Point C, I will bring them back, a reference to restoration from the tribulation dispersion. Restoration from the tribulation dispersion. Then he says, I will have mercy on them. And for those of you that have been with me from the very beginning months ago, that should trigger your mind back to Hosea, where there was a time period when God said there will be a period of time when Israel is lo ruchamah, not pitied. But, he says, that will come to an end and they will be pitied once again. Here's another reference to the end of the lo ruchamah, the not pitied period. And then point E, same thing should happen. They shall be as though I had not cast them off. Again, back to Hosea, there was the time of Jezreel, God's scattering. Do you remember that? But I will not only scatter them, but I will also sow them in their land. And here's where the scattering comes to an end and Israel is sown in the land. The time of Jezreel is over with. So again, like I said earlier, a lot of these doctrines are repeated over and over again in Scripture. And when you learn to recognize them, you'll see, okay, yeah, that's a reference back to a different prophet. Finally, in point F, he says, I am Jehovah their God, I will hear them. This is in contrast to the past when God would not hear us because of our sins. For example, Isaiah 59:2 reads, but your iniquities have made a separation between you and your God. Your sins have hidden his face from you so that he does not hear. But now, after the tribulation period, when Israel is regenerated, God will hear us. A great contrast to the past. And the results come out in verse 7. Ephraim will be like a mighty man, and their heart will be glad as if from wine. Indeed, their children will see it and be glad. Their heart will rejoice in the Lord. And so two basic points there. The point A is joy in victory. Joy in victory. And point B is trust in God. Trust in God, because Israel will be a regenerated nation at that time. We will be trusting in God. So joy in victory and trust in God, points A and B. Now at this point, we slide on into the kingdom. The tribulation period has come to an end in verse 7, and now in verse 8 we move on into the messianic kingdom itself, and we spend a short period of time there in verses 8 through 12. So this is the restoration of Israel. We begin with the regathering, verses 8 and 9. I will whistle for them to gather them together, for I have redeemed them, and they will be as numerous as they were before. When I scatter them among the peoples, they will remember me in far countries, and they with their children will live and come back. I will hiss for them, point one. This is the shepherd calling his sheep. He's whistling for them, making his particular call for his sheep. And here again, the Messiah is being pictured, God is being pictured as the good shepherd gathering his flock. And of course, that's how Yeshua pictured himself as well. I am the good shepherd. So God is the good shepherd. Why does he redeem them or regather them? Point two, because he's redeemed them. See, their regathering follows their salvation. Romans 11, 25 through 27. All Israel will be saved. Once we're a regenerated nation, once every living Jewish man, woman, and child has placed their faith in Yeshua, then, after he has redeemed us, then he regathers us. Point three, after the regathering, there'll be an increase in population. Why is that needed? We'll learn when we come to the end of Zechariah that two-thirds of the Jewish nation will be killed during the tribulation. So it's very appropriate to have a growth in population to fill the kingdom. Now, I disagree with point four that Dr. Fruchtenbaum has here. I will sow them among the peoples. He states there, to be sent out among the Gentiles to win them to God. And that's a possibility. I think in the context, though, it's a prediction of the diaspora judgment, that I will sow them among the peoples. Then point five occurs, they will remember me in the far countries, among the Gentiles. We will turn our attention to Yeshua and remember that he came and remember and come to the conclusion that he is our Messiah. Matthew 23:39 will say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Then they shall live with their children. Not only will we be saved physically, but also spiritually by the Messiah, by that remembrance of Yeshua in the far countries. We won't be annihilated by the Antichrist. And point seven, we'll return to Israel. So just a short little history there of the reminder of the tribulation, diaspora, and salvation that results in this regathering. So the regathering is a result of redemption. That regathering is from among the Gentiles in verse 10. I will bring them back from the land of Egypt and gather them from Assyria. And I will bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon until no room can be found for them. So here God points out two key areas from which the return will occur. And I've just superimposed the boundaries of Israel on a modern map. So he says the people will return from Egypt. That will be a major source of the return. The people will return from Assyria, again another major source of the return. And they'll come to Lebanon, which is this area here, called Lebanon today. And they will come to Gilead, which is this area here. And he says that the land will be, no place will be found for them. The point there is total settlement. In other words, the entire land will be filled with Jewish people. Just to give you an idea of what that's like, we learn in Ezekiel of the tribal breakdowns during the millennial kingdom. The tribes will be divided up in this manner from north to south. Millennial Mount Zion here in the middle. And so the land will be fully populated by the Jewish people, especially when we multiply and increase our population. So I'll hand out that map to you. I have a suspicion that you would all like to see that. So I went ahead and duplicated it. Now, one of the students in the day class said, well, that's still a pretty small section of territory. And you're right, that's not a huge country there. Israel and the Messianic Kingdom is going to be a lot smaller than California is now. But size does not belie importance. It'll still be the capital country of the planet, even though it is going to be far from being the largest country on the planet. Okay, the end of verse 10 then. They will come into Gilead and Lebanon until no room can be found for them. In other words, total settlement of the land. Fully populated. the land will be fully populated by the Jewish people. So I expect to be there, guys. I don't know exactly where I'll be living, but somewhere there. I don't know which tribe I'm assigned to. All right, the punishment of the Gentiles is also part of this whole picture, and that's referred to in verse 11. And he will pass through the sea of distress and strike the waves in the sea, so that the depths of the Nile will dry up, and the pride of Assyria will be brought down, and the scepter of Egypt will depart. So on page 338, the first reference is to the Red Sea. That Sea of Distress is the Red Sea when we came out of Egypt in our flight from Pharaoh, the Sea of Affliction, the Sea of Distress. And then he refers to that same section of territory, talking about the Nile being dried up. So that area in Egypt is going to be devastated in preparation for the kingdom. He also notes that the pride of Assyria is going to be brought down. That other very important area of from which Jewish people return will be defeated. So I don't know, those might be the areas of concentration camps or something during the tribulation period. I don't know, but there's going to be a lot of Jewish people in Assyria and in Egypt, and both of those countries are going to be devastated and defeated, allowing the Jewish people to return for the kingdom. Point D there, the scepter of Egypt shall depart. That's an indicator that there will be no Egyptian kingdom. And we learned from a study of Egypt that for the first 40 years, Egypt will be desolated, and the Egyptians will be dispersed all over the world. And I'm sorry, I haven't gotten the verse down here. But after 40 years, they will be regathered, and there will be a kingdom of Egypt during the millennial kingdom after the first 40 years of desolation. But in the beginning, the scepter of Egypt shall depart. She will be defeated. And that apparently will allow Jewish people to return. Now, a very similar statement is made in Isaiah 11, 15 and 16. So I thought I'd put that up and read it to you so you could see the similar reference. And the Lord will utterly destroy the tongue of the Sea of Egypt. That's the Red Sea as it comes up there. And he will wave his hand over the river with his scorching wind. That'd be a reference to the Euphrates, to Assyria. So here's a reference to Egypt, and here's a reference to Assyria. With his scorching wind, and he will strike it into seven streams and make men walk over dry shod. So the Euphrates apparently will be changed quite a bit due to geological changes there. It won't be a major river anymore. And there will be a highway from Assyria for the remnant of his people who will be left, just as there was for Israel in the day that they came up out of the land of Egypt. So here's a reference to that return from Assyria as well, with the Euphrates River being changed in such a way that it will not hinder any kind of a return of the Jewish people from Assyria. So there will be a punishment on Assyria and Egypt. That is part of the return and the setting up of the kingdom. But there's also a spiritual restoration in verse 12. And I shall strengthen them in the Lord, and in his name they will walk, declares the Lord. Now there has to be a restoration and regeneration of Israel before all this can happen. And that's what verse 12 is referring to. Being strengthened in the Lord and walking in the name of the Lord indicates a nation that is characterized by righteousness and a nation that is characterized by faith. And a good cross-reference for that is Romans 11, 25 through 27 again, where all Israel shall be saved. Every Jewish person who is alive at the end of the tribulation will turn to Yeshua in faith and be regenerated. We'll have a saved nation that enters into the kingdom. Now the day class is a bit more verbose than you guys. They get me off on all kinds of tangents with their questions. So I'm done a little early. We finished up with the day class at chapter 11. So I'm going to quit right here at chapter 11. And we'll pick that up next week. I hope to do chapter 11 and 12 next week before our break. So let's call it quits for tonight. And let me go ahead and close in prayer. And I'll turn you loose, and I appreciate all your help with the cleanup. Sure appreciate that. Okay, let's go to prayer.